This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week, we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. So today's guest is one of them. This man was born in England, and while he may originate from the motherland, we certainly claim this man to be our own. His upbringing and struggle with alcohol addiction could have easily made this young gay man a statistic in the fight to find equality in Australia, but it was his personal strength and support by his family that led him to become a Hollywood name. His first big acting role saw him co-star along Gina Davis in the critically acclaimed Accidents Happen. Shortly after that, he featured in more feature films and has worked alongside Sam Neill and Brian Brown, just to name a few. However, over the last few years, it has been a topic of conversation in the media regarding his determination to be an out gay man, but also to continue his passion to act. It's seen him win awards amongst the LGBTI community and also become a household name. And at the moment, his book Pink Ink is out with his mantra, "It's never too late to be yourself." I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Harry Cook to Word for Word.
I was just so desperate to find somebody who I could kind of go, oh my God, okay, so we're on the same team. Like, you understand what I'm feeling? Like, it felt like I was just, I didn't know anybody who was gay. It would have been a terrifying thing to see your son chatting to random people online. The second time I came out, everything went really, really, really bad. I started drinking daily, doing drugs. It was really violent for a really long period of time, and I was a nightmare to live with. So I think that was probably a part of it as well. I was like, I don't want to wait till I'm 18. I want to know if I'm gay. What does that mean? How can I navigate this? And I just wanted to act, and I always had wanted to act, but I think I felt like bullying at school, I didn't have the means to pursue it. If I have a drink, it's like I don't see any other reason of having one unless to get hammered.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, the first time that we had any contact with each other, yeah. Do you remember what it was?
I think on Twitter. Was it on Twitter?
It wasn't. It was. We both did Hello Sunday Morning.
Oh my God, of course.
What's the best way to describe Hello Sunday Morning?
Hello Sunday Morning. It's, I guess, a gateway into trying a night off the booze. That's how I would look at Hello
Sunday. It's like putting a microscope over people's drinking and looking at the culture of it.
Absolutely. Much better way of putting it than
I obviously did more research on being an ambassador.
So, that is absolutely looking at the drinking culture that we have, which, to be honest, isn't really a culture. Like, we are incredible binge drinkers in this country, I feel. I feel like it is an incredibly
100%.
You know, binging sort of culture that we have. So
it's weird to see so many young people, though, these days, because the statistics are dropping. Mm. That culture is changing quite a bit, where younger people aren't drinking as much as what we used to.
Yeah. I think I'm very aware of how my experience with alcohol and drugs was. So I'm 100% behind, you know, October and taking a month just to kind of detox, because there's a lot of people, I think, who hammer the booze so hard, and I don't think anybody realizes not just the mental effects but the physical effects. Like, it can really do a lot of damage.
We're going to get into a whole lot of that as we go on, but going back to the origins of Harry Cook, you were born in the UK.
Yes. Yeah, South London, Croydon. I think it was a bit lower socioeconomic where we lived. Wasn't that bad, but it was just a lot of, like, we got held up in a post office when I was like
by a gunman.
By a gunman, yeah. He came in with a gun, made the cashier empty the till. There was like two girls who were abducted in a field. Like, it was like
the drama.
It was a drama. I know. I feel like going back and just like creating a TV show about it, like the 90s in Croydon. It sounds amazing.
What was your childhood like in that area?
Fine. I actually had I don't remember anything besides the, you know, nearly being a shot at. I didn't find anything too difficult to get along. We weren't rich. We weren't poor either, but we weren't sort of swimming in money or anything. We just had a pretty normal childhood. It was really kind of down to earth. It was when I moved here, when I was 10 years old when I first moved here. It was funny because I always remember. Do you remember when you first realized you were a bit different? Is it? Do you remember a time?
My whole life, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah,
a little bit left of center.
Definitely
didn't fit in all the time with the kids at school.
Yeah,
was more than happy most of the time to be either the mother and the mothers and fathers which you played at school, rather than being the father.
My God,
happy to be the mum, the daughter, or the sister. And then mum would enroll me like in football and things like that, little league, and I'd stand on the side and talk to them about movies.
Yes,
like, forget the football. Come over here and talk to me.
Oh, my God. It's like we've lived the same life. Honestly, actually, I was at a... The title of my book is actually called Pink Ink, and I went to a... It was like one of my brother's footy matches when I was about... I think it must have been 13. And I was just realizing. I was like, oh, no, I like guys. It sort of clicked around that time. And this guy came up, and he was like, so what do you want to be when you're older? Like one of my the parents' friends. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be an actor. Because everybody just is
sure,
of course, duh,
pie in the sky,
yeah, easy. And he goes, yeah, right, okay. And then he turned around, and I swear I heard him go, God, that one's gay as pink ink. And I, at the time, I was like, is that like a, wow, is that like a VIP, like Pink Incorporated? I was like, will I get like a card? Will I get like a little membership card? Like, am I going to get a badge? Is it like Star Trek? Obviously, it wasn't. He was being a jerk.
He kind of was, but at the same time, we do fit into a community these days, and yes. I think we need a badge.
Totally. Yeah, we do.
Harry, show me a badge.
Where's your badge?
Yeah.
Where's your damn badge?
No, it's actually kind of funny, though. What was your relationship like then with your parents as you were growing up?
Great. I mean, me and my parents got along really, really well, funnily enough. And my grandparents, like we all. But there was a moment when I realized me and my dad were very different. And I did write about it in the book. I was probably about 4. And we went to the Wheatgift Center, which is like a massive, massive mall in Croydon, South London. And they took me to the Disney store. And there was a million different toys that, you know, my younger brother was playing with, like Buzz Lightyears and Woody dolls, and I had like beelined, made a way for the princess corner because there was where all the like the
of course
girls' dresses were, and I was like, this is where my home is. Get out of the way. And I asked my parents, I was like, it's nearly Christmas. Can I please, 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 please have the Snow White dress, which was like one of my favorite movies when I was growing up? And my mum went, oh, maybe, and my dad went, no way. There's no way you're getting that. You're not a girl, are you? And I was like, no. Sure, yeah, I'm not a girl, but hang on, what does that even have to do? It didn't even, I think as kids, like, because you don't really even realize, do you know what I mean? Like, that hasn't even come into the equation. It's like, oh, well, I like doing that, so that, why would that be an issue? So we kind of fought a bit in the store, and then he went, okay, no, you can have it. I'll get it for you. I'll buy you the dress. It's an early Christmas present, but you have to wear it out of the store. And I was like, you know what? Never mind. Like, whereas before, I think before, without that little, like, you're different, I probably would have. I'd probably be like, whatever, I will walk it out of there. I didn't care. It was when I realized how apparently that was wrong. Apparently I shouldn't be doing this, that it kind of shifted and your consciousness changed. And I think from there I was like, oh, you think of me a bit differently and I am a bit different. And I think that's, a lot of kids must have that when they kind of realize that, oh, I'm not like everybody else.
It's weird when you think of the gender-defining roles that we seem to have placed on people. And then when you look at kids, I remember a teacher coming over and saying, oh, look, Ben, you're sitting with the girls. Come back over here and sit with the boys. And that sort of thing you wouldn't see in schools these days. Like, teachers would never do that to someone.
No, absolutely, yeah.
So I think we're sort of breaking the culture of it. But I certainly remember thinking, yeah, I was gravitating towards more feminine ideals.
Yeah.
And was totally fine with it. And I think it's really cute when you see kids like that.
Totally.
You see,
oh, my God.
Like little boys walking into school and you see them holding hands or all that sort of stuff. And you think, where are we in society when we try and make kids feel bad about those things?
Exactly. Totally.
It's yuck.
It is so yuck. And we've had, like, extended family who've been, like, we've gone over for Christmas and, like, a boy will get a Barbie doll and one of the grandparents would be like, oh, they don't play with them, do they? It's like, well, he's a child. Like, he plays whatever he wants. Like, they don't.
Does that kid look happy?
I know. Yeah, right? Exactly.
Let that kid do whatever that child would like to do.
It just seems funny.
I'd still play with Barbies, I reckon.
Oh, my God, I would too. I would too. In fact, after this, I'm going to go buy one, and I'm going to send one to you to the studio.
We're going off on a tangent. Sorry. So, you have a very strong relationship with your mum, and your mum's always been very supportive through and through. She never wavered.
No, she was great. I think the first time I came out, I was about 14, and
you came out twice?
Yeah, kind of. I came out, didn't go so well. They were just sort of like, my mum cried, my dad left the room in sort of a rage, and then they came back in, and I was like, you know what? I think I'm just
confused.
Don't know. I'm gonna head back over here, lock the closet door, and just sort of. I went and found a girlfriend and tried that. That was fine.
It's the worst feeling when you feel like you have to pretend to be someone you're not.
It's the worst, and it's the worst trying because I knew very well that being with this girl was solely for appearances. But I do think that a lot of it comes down to. I think young gay kids are so scared. I think that's what a lot of it comes down to. I was petrified. Were you scared when you were growing up of like being revealed?
I was so scared, and I remember thinking once I would be found out, I couldn't go along to my grandparents' like lunches because I couldn't sit at the table because I'd be worried about what they thought of me.
Yeah.
And you think of all this unnecessary stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they had a slight inkling with you and I. Like, we were... You're wearing a Snow White dress.
Exactly. I was like, there were clues that one should have probably picked up on.
I had a mother's meeting that was happening on the side of the football oval. Did your parents have any idea?
I think my mum did. I think my dad did too, but I just think he put it away. Yeah. I really, truly think that was probably... And I do think as well, back then, I mean, I came out to them nearly 15, 20 years ago. It must have been... I came out when I was 13. So, 15 years ago or so. Roughly.
You know what I'm really impressed with, though, is that you came out when you were 13. I didn't tell my parents until I was 21.
I have a lot of respect for people like you, though, who waited, because I think you would obviously have been in a better position as well to look after yourself. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes I am all for, you know, kids coming out. I do think that. But I think sometimes it's you do need to make sure that you are in a healthy place and you are in, you know, you're sane of mind. Like, I was so young when I came out, and to get a rejection is like, you know, you're still trying to figure yourself out. So I think. I have a lot of respect for people who go, no, now's not the right time to come out. I will get there, but, you know, it's each to their own, I guess. That's what.
What about your dad? I mean, there was obviously some ups and downs, which you mentioned in the book. How would you describe that relationship with him after being 13 and telling him that you thought you might be gay?
Yeah, I mean, that was... I think those times were just horrendous, and I don't think it was even... And looking back, I've always... thought of it now in terms of like where we are now, like we've got so many resources. It's all about like empowering young gay youth. And when I came out, I remember there being nothing of that. There was no like Wear It Purple Day, or you know, if there was, it was very out in the middle of. I don't remember there being no Trevor Project or It Gets Better Project or
nothing. Like
there was nothing like that. And I mean, Will and Grace was on TV, but we were kind of the butt of the joke of that. Like we, and it was never on in my household anyway. So back then, and I'm definitely not justifying, you know, the ignorance side of it with my dad, but I don't think he had any idea how to comprehend with it.
What there was, though, at that time, and I think was a lot of stranger danger to do with sex. And so linking people's sex and sexuality with the disease during that time frame was panic stations. So in actual fact, I think your dad was probably expressing fear.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And I think when you meet people that have fear in them, they react badly.
So true.
Most of the time in my life, when I reflect over my bad behavior, my bad behavior is always linked back to being fearful of something.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, it's always something a lot deeper than just, I don't like that. My dad was actually, from the get-go, said, I'm so scared of losing you. He'd grown up in the UK where apparently I read Matthew Todd has written a book called Straight Jacket, and it's about, you know, gay shame and especially the UK's media and how the UK just absolutely destroyed the nation with sort of anti-gay propaganda during the AIDS epidemic, where it was literally the worst kind of media attention you could possibly get. So everybody, they were looked upon as,
you're going to get HIV and die.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And then you think about these mums and dads with their babies and they go, oh, yeah. you know, I'm yeah. going to lose my child when exactly. they tell us that. And then flash forward to 2018, the way we are now.
Yep.
And like your parents, for you, you're like, you're married.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly.
Definitely not a life sentence.
No, no, exactly. And it's such a, it's so funny because I've never actually, I never thought that me and my dad would get to this place that we are now. But I mean, props to him. He could have been one of the many, like you see the hundreds and hundreds of stories of the you know, the families that completely break apart and they never ever speak again because of, you know,
someone coming out.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Someone coming out and then just being absolutely not able to get to let it go. But my dad, he was the only one at a PFLAG meeting for like 6 months. He really, really tried. I think it got to the point where I was so hurt by it that I couldn't let it go. I think that was it. It took a while for us to get back together because I was then resenting him on a much deeper level.
What was the age difference then between your sibling, which is Max?
Yes.
So your younger brother?
Yes.
What's the age difference?
4 years. 4 years old? Yeah. 4 years older. I am.
And how do you describe his personality as different to yours?
Polar opposite. Like I have always been, always from like the dawn of time, I've always been lover of books, of musicals. Like I'm into like everything that's glitter, like just anything that's fun and stupid and over the top. Whereas Max is like, he plays rugby, he goes to the gym and eats meat, and he's good at it, and he's a lovely guy, and I adore him. Like he's such a good man. Like he's a really good guy. But we could not be more, we're just polar opposites of the spectrum, which is kind of funny because we do actually get along despite that. A lot of the time I was kind of thinking, oh my god, we're so different, but it kind of works in our favor, I think.
What was Harry Cook like as a child?
I was a nuisance, a pest. No, I was so full of energy, which is weird because I'm not as energetic now. In fact, I'm much more like introverted than I thought I would be. Like, growing up, I was into like, I could not find a camera quick enough. Like if my dad got out the camcorder, I would have to be in front of it. But now I'm not as much like that. I was really, really nervous. I was petrified of everything. I don't know where I've spoken to a few gay people in the past few months, especially with the book now out and stuff. And I've always been intrigued at if anxiety was a part of your life when you were growing up. Were you scared of anything to do with family? Like, I was always so scared of losing my mum. Like, my mum was like my everything as a kid. I don't know whether
My mum would drop me off at Scouts or anything that was extracurricular.
Yes.
And the thing that's sort of traumatizing with this story was, well, for many different reasons, but mum taught at my primary school. So I didn't have that time where you drop the kids off at school and you didn't see them. So mum was there all the way up until grade six.
Right.
So then leading up until being a 12-year-old, I had extreme fear that I would be sick or something would happen to me if I was separated from my mum at all. Mum would try and drop me off at kids' birthdays at like 9, and I'd be like,
exactly how I was. Petrified. My mum couldn't even go to work during the day. I'd be like, this is just not going to work. You're going to have to work from home.
The thing, though, is I think I've never really thought about this, and you've highlighted it, and that is that anxiety that's there.
Yeah.
And where that gets created from and what link that has back to being a gay boy, I don't know.
I'm fascinated in like young gay kids and like what we feed them from a really early age. Mm. I'm fascinated by it because when I was growing up and when you were growing up, I don't remember there being any queer representation pretty much at all. At all. Or I remember getting across from the States, like Philadelphia or Angels in America, which, and I'm not saying those stories are so important to be told. They're without a doubt very, very important stories. But there was no, I think growing up and you see yourselves, when you don't see yourselves in anything represented anywhere, and the stuff you do see is very, very morbid. It's about, you know, death and dying, or, you know, you're going to get sick or you're going to get attacked and bashed. Mm. Like the Matthew Shepard story was on television, I think, in the 98s or something. So that even that I was... But, like, when that's all you see, I think you start to self-obliterate, I think. Anyway, I think I got to the point when I was 13 and I was like, better get it over and done with then. Like, started drinking earlier because I was like, this isn't how... Gay people don't live happily. Like that was all, and I know that I'm very ignorant to say that. That's not me saying that in 2018. That was me when I was a 13-year-old, because I genuinely was like, well, we don't have happy lives, because there was nothing I could see. I remember being like, well, where are they? I don't see them anywhere, which is a shame because I think now, now we see a lot of. I'm so grateful to see so many more, like, you know, Glee and Love, Simon, and there are projects out there now that are showing that you can have a happy life. But I don't remember any of that growing up, so I think that tees in with the anxiety side of things.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. What age were you then that you had your first drink?
13, 14.
How did you get your hands on a first drink?
I was like a man child. Like, I actually, do you know what? And this is no word of a lie, because I always thought, oh, I must have to buy it from somebody else. The first drink I bought a case of Double Blacks at a Thirsty Merc concert in Warriewood. And I'm not going to say the name of the...
reputable retailer.
Reputable retailer. But I bought it with... I made a European identity card on paint and got it laminated because it was like, it was a European card and you just, it's a laminate. It hadn't changed my date of birth.
Oh, you were one of those smart
kids. Well, I was insane, really.
You're a delinquent. Okay. You're like, I said smart, but I meant delinquent.
Delinquent. Yeah. Yes.
If you're looking at that though, so 13 is your first drink, but it's also the first time you tried to attempt coming out with your parents. Mm. What came first in that scenario?
Actually, it was coming out.
So you came out.
Came out, didn't go right.
And then went and bought a drink.
It, not that day, but yeah, it was shortly afterwards. So that is, I think there is something massive to say about gay shame and the link between alcoholism and addiction.
It's just so, I think you forget about what people go through.
Yeah.
And you forget about what it's like to be a young person and then struggle with your own emotions in such a encapsulated scenario.
Totally.
That you're trying to just find love and burst out of something.
Totally.
Can you think about what it's like to be a 13-year-old in that mindset?
Yeah. No. That's... I mean... Did you remember, like, realizing how you didn't like yourself as a kid? Like, did you have any of that? Like, when you realized you were gay? Because when I was like... Oh my God, I'm gay. That was like acknowledgement. I can't really get out of this, which is shit, which is a not a nice feeling to be like, oh, this is it. This is the card you've been dealt. And then you kind of have to surrender to it. But then I was like, but there's nothing, I don't know where to go from here. I just remember feeling like there wasn't much hope as a young gay kid.
What was your first impression or knowledge of gay people? So not like an experience, but like, what was the first time you realized men can like men and women can like women?
That's a really good question. I think it was, it would have been really early on. I think it was at school. So when I was in the UK, someone at school said, faggot. And I actually inquired and said, what does that mean? Like, what are you talking about? And some idiot was like, oh, it's two guys, you do it. And I think I actually remember being like, I don't understand. Like, I didn't even, yeah, I think it's funny, you've kind of knocked something out. I do remember being at school and somebody saying that and then not actually still understanding what they meant. Like, whether it was, what, so are they like boyfriend? Like, I think it was so ingrained that, like, no, men and women go together, that the minute I heard otherwise, I was like, that's a thing, like, that can happen.
Like, I think it's disappointing though that in both these situations, when you came out, said in a negative connotation.
Yeah.
So, like, so far with you and having any knowledge of your sexuality or of who you were hit with, like,
how bad it could be. Yeah. Yeah. I just feel like there was no level of understanding of what being gay actually was for them either. I feel like my dad knew what being gay meant. I think he had this very media blasted idea of everybody wears feathers and goes to Mardi Gras every day of the week, and it's all just, you know, sex and parties and drugs, and I think that was what he must have just expected was across the board. And even if it was, I mean, he was just so, I think he was just petrified. To be perfectly honest, and I've had long conversations with him about it, because I've, like, for the book in particular, but also just in general since, because I was sort of like, what about it, like, scared you so much? And he was like, he was scared of me dying young. And I was like, but if you knew how far we've come as a medical society, even, like, even if you take away, like, if you were worried about me catching HIV, for example, if you did the research, you would know that it's not the death sentence that it was 20 years ago when you knew about gay people. Like, he had all these beliefs held from the 80s where they had sort of hammered them into him, and I don't think he had any idea how to break them. He would just thought, well, no, gay people wear this and they do that, and that's all that there is. But that boils down, I think, to representation, not just for gay people, but for straight people as well. They need to see it. It's a shame, I think. But I think what is so wrong with the world right now is that there's too little willingness to sort of learn, I think. And there's no excuse anymore. Back then, like, to learn about anything, you had to go to the library, or you had to, you know, like, we've got...
You have to go out of your way.
You have to go out of your way to learn anything and to become, you know, not ignorant anymore. Nowadays, you've got a library on your mobile phone. Like, there is not an excuse to be homophobic anymore. I said to my dad the other day, like, I would hope, you know, if things were different and I'd grown up now and I came out now, that it wouldn't have happened the way it happened. I feel like, and I don't think it would have. I don't think he had the resources in front of him to cope.
Tell me a little bit about your schooling. So, you know, what you were like going through school.
School was a nightmare for me. Did you enjoy school? I really could not get through it. In fact, I barrel rolled my way through it until I could leave. I was miserable at school. And not because I didn't want to learn. I think that was a shame. I wish I had sort of the years and wisdom now to go back to school and be like, I don't care what any of you think. But I don't, unfortunately. And back then, I was so focused on what everybody else thought of me, which was little. They didn't think of me at all, really. I was bullied really, really badly.
Was it the accent then? Because maybe...
I think it was maybe, yeah.
Because that's another thing of fear. Like, maybe they just were unfamiliar
could
with
have
that.
Been, yeah. I think that yeah, the
kids
accent...
Kids look for the smallest amount totally. Of difference in
and
someone.
They dig it out. For it. They go for it.
What age did you then retry and come out? So, like, you tried to come out at 13 and then you tried to reapproach it again at 15?
I think it was. Yeah, I think it was 15, just, or like 14 and 10 months, 15 or so, roughly about then. And that went horrifically, actually. That was so bad that I... And the worst thing was it got to the point where I was not only sort of horrendous time at school, it was then at home again. So I couldn't actually... It was like I didn't really have anywhere...
To go.
Like, it's one thing when you're being bullied all day at school, but then to come home and my dad was like just furious about the fact that I told him. It was really violent for a really long period of time. And I was a nightmare to live with as well, because I wasn't letting any of
it. Were you physically violent towards him or the other way around?
Both, backwards and forwards. I think I was... It depends as well. Like, some of the things, I think if it was... If some of the things he said were so vicious at times, then I would sort of give him a push to get him out of my way or something. But it was so weird, because it was only after, I think, because from there everything sort of crumbled. When the second time I came out, everything went really, really, really bad. I started drinking sort of daily, doing drugs.
The thing that was interesting for me when I was reading your book was the fact that you were getting in online and talking to people.
Yes.
Which is very common as well. Like, you know, the internet was just really starting to be what we know the internet to be today. But you connected with people online.
Yeah.
How did you find out about these websites?
It was just MySpace, I think. And then in MySpace, I remember you could like, you could filter through sexuality and location. So I would be like Sydney and questioning or gay and then start talking. So I guess it was like a very early Grindr, I guess, in a way.
MySpace was Grindr?
Yeah.
I was doing it wrong. But still, I mean, that's 15 years of age and you're connecting with people online. Do you can imagine how terrifying that is for parents?
Terrifying.
Be like, terrifying. What are these
especially
kids?
Especially with the, you know, they're getting all of this chat room. You know, like, my dad was like, you're going to go down a chat room and someone's going to kill you. Like, which, to be honest, like, that isn't a crazy thought. Like, to my dad, who grew up
in Croydon
without internet, it would have been a terrifying thing to see your son, you know, chatting to random people online. That I think was the difference. But I was just so desperate to find somebody who I could kind of go, oh my God, okay, so we're on the same team. Like, you understand what I'm feeling? Like, it felt like I was just, I didn't know anybody who was gay, anybody near me. It was only when I moved schools that I met someone who was gay.
Like, it's so brave though to think that you got on a bus by yourself and went and met up with someone that
you
found on...
Or delusional. Or a little bit mad.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
But, like, at 15 years of age, I would have gone into the city to buy a comic book, but I could not imagine to go and meet a man. Do you know what I mean? Like, but you went and met somebody.
Yeah.
How do you describe that experience when you meet someone at 15 who's like you for the first time?
I mean, to be honest, he was the same age as me. I think the first guy I met online, we went to the movies together. He was the same age. He lived in, I think it was somewhere out west, but he was, I think, just so excited. I think it was such an innocent sort of thing. Like, it was, looking back, it was no... I don't even think we were looking for, like, relationships as such. It was more like just, oh, my God, we've found, like, another lifeline. Like, his family weren't very cool with it. So, yeah, I think I remember just being like, oh, my God, thank God. I can breathe a little bit. Somebody else out there. Like, it's like you found water on a planet that has no water. It's just it was more that than anything... too sort of sexual, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like I was desperate just to go and have a boyfriend. It was more, I think it was more like a life raft in a way. And I think I was like, if not now, when? I think that was how I was so, because I'd already came out to my dad, and I think he was sort of like, well, you don't know what you are. Like, you don't know yet. And I'm like, no, I do, and I'm going to find out more. Like, I was a bit of a, like, that's...
I'm curious. That's
yeah,
what you were.
Yeah, yeah, very, very curious. And just a bit brazen. I'm incredibly impatient. I always have been. That's like Liam, one of his pet hates with me. I'm so impatient when it comes to anything. So I think that was probably a part of it as well. I was like, I don't want to wait till I'm 18. I want to know if I'm gay. What does that mean? How can I navigate this? And how can I be happy? I think
we're looking for acceptance.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We're looking to be loved. And I think, you know, we are entitled to those things, or we feel we're entitled to those things, I guess.
Yeah.
But I guess for you, your struggles with things led to substance abuse and alcoholism.
Yes.
And so that sort of came into effect sort of 16, 17, 18. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I got my... After I finished TAFE, I went and worked at a lolly store in the mall near my house.
Yeah, right.
Just to make some money, because I'd just left school by that point. I'd left school early, and I had signed with a young talent company who sent kids out for auditions to whatever... you know, whatever casting that came in. And he called one day and went, I've got this movie. I don't know whether you're interested in it, but it's for one of the leads in a role. And it's got Gina Davis. She's, and I was like, I know her. It's like, she's in it. And he went, yeah. So it's going to, you're going for one of her sons in the movie. And I was like, oh my God. And he went, yeah, but you know, I wouldn't, don't freak out or anything. Like, there's a lot. And I was like, when is it? So anyway, he sent me for it. It's like three. It was the most stressful process I think I've ever been in. And since, I haven't been as terrified of an audition since. I think because it was like the one thing that I thought might, you know.
Take you away from drinking and alcohol?
Yeah.
So I've been drinking and drugs?
Totally, yeah. And I was miserable at that time. I was like, I was working at a lolly store, getting absolutely hammered. And I just wanted to act, and I always had wanted to act, but I think I felt like bullying at school, I didn't have the means to pursue it. Unfortunately, I just didn't have that in me to stick it out at school. I just was like, this is going to kill me if I have to keep being around this. It was so toxic. And yeah, after like, it was like 6 months of auditions or something, and they had people from America in the mix, and it was an amazing experience. But yeah, eventually they gave me the part. And that, I think, is when my drinking and drugs calm down, when I was working. And then as soon as I stopped working, I would start up again. It was like I couldn't just be happy at myself.
Self-sabotage in a way.
Totally.
Was there anything in your family that suggested that maybe alcoholism or addiction to personality had come down the line?
Yeah, I mean, I've often thought that. My great-granddad was an alcoholic, and I also think it's that mixed with my incredibly anxious nature. I worry about everything. I think that was another way that I just numbed myself.
What do you do now when you think about ways to numb yourself? Because, I mean, obviously, we still, as adults, we're like anxious people. What do you do to try and keep yourself on track? Like,
meditate. I focus on reading and breathing more. I think growing up, you have no idea, like, the tools to just get through a day at school, let alone, I think everything comes with wisdom and with a bit of time. So I think that, yeah, I think I've just learnt to hang in there as long as you can, because eventually it does get better. But yeah, without alcohol, I sometimes still don't know how I've managed to go 6.5 years without having a drink, even on those really horrible days. You know, when you're just like,
I need to have a
drink.
Yeah.
Just one drink. But it was never one. That's my...
This is something I've never asked somebody who's an alcoholic before.
Do it.
But I feel like if I was an alcoholic, I'd be more inclined to want to drink on like a summer day,
yes,
or something positive,
yes,
than I would to reach for a drink because I was
having a
bad day. Like for me on a bad day or even by myself, I never drink by myself.
No. I used to look like that a lot. And I relapsed. I mentioned it in the book, but I did relapse because I was like, I'm fine. Maybe it was just a bad time in my life. I was just going through a lot. You know, like I'm cured now. I'm recovered. Whatever. I can have a drink. And it went straight back to how it was. It feels like, in my experience of being an alcoholic and recovery and trying to learn how to live without it, it seems like the harder I if I have a drink, it's like I don't see any other reason of having one unless to get hammered, which is a horrible way of looking at it. But I've always been waiting for like age to hit me and go, that's not what you want to do. But every single time I think of an alcoholic beverage, I'm like, well, that will get me out of my head and I won't have to think. It's not, I don't have that kind of connection to alcohol.
That's what you tapped into, though.
Yeah.
I think, I often think my drinking is bad. That's why we both did the Hello Sunday Morning. And so I put a magnifying glass over my drinking and I thought, maybe I'm an alcoholic because, you know, the culture of Australia is that we drink. Something good happens, we drink. We go on, it's a Friday, we drink.
Sure, yeah.
You think of all these things. And I wanted to put a magnifying glass over that.
Especially, like, in our community, I think we are so much more likely to turn to drink and drugs. I think that is a huge, huge part of because of the world we grow up in. I think it is a lot about sort of blotting stuff out. I'm in no way shaming anybody who wants to go and have a drink and have a party and go and have fun. That's absolutely not the thing. But I do think that there is something to say that if you are going out and trying to forget who you are every night, as I was so unhappy with myself. I was so ashamed of being gay for such a long time that it was like, I just want to get out of my head. I don't want to think about it anymore. And the alcohol or the drugs or whatever I could get in... whatever I could get in, I would suck the alcohol out of a deodorant stick if it got me high. Like it's a shame because that seemed to be the only option that I could kind of have a bit of relief.
I reckon your story, in a way, it wakes people up and you have a huge amount of people following you. I mean, even your coming out video had 75,000 hits like on it overnight. Yeah. Did you ever think that you would become this prolific?
No, I still don't. Still don't think I am. I can't look at myself in any way. I still find it hilarious that anybody like is remotely interested in me. And it's lovely when people are. I think I've seen the industry as such a roller coaster. I know that like you get amazing highs when you're working and you're the hottest thing in town for 6 months and then nobody really wants to cast you for a little while. And then you're doing another movie, so everybody's really likes you. So I don't really take it seriously as much as I thought I would growing up. Like when I was growing up, I was like, I'm going to be a star. Like, you know what I mean? You think that it's going to be so much fun. Like everybody's going to, but I don't look at it like that anymore. I did. I was so ignorant to like the industry when I was growing up, but I started
naive to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me this. What makes a good actor?
Oh, good question. Honesty, I think. And also, I think the best performances are the ones where they're not. I've got a funny thing with acting as well, because I come from a place where I try and feel it as much as I can, because a lot of people, I noticed that some people will practice so hard, especially in the theatre world, which is important, like rehearsals are very important, but practice, and it's sort of like you're just sort of repeating something, whereas I find acting, the best kinds of performances are when you have absolutely no idea where that came from, or like the line is so sort of organic. I love that about an actor. So I think honesty and maybe just a little bit of rawness, if that's a way of saying it.
It's got to be believable.
Yeah.
And I think that it's
the
nuances that you can create as an actor that makes you a good actor.
Absolutely.
So it's not necessarily the dialogue. It's usually the small things that you can convey,
exactly.
I guess, in your storytelling. I'm obsessed with Gina Davis, so I have to ask you this. For your age, was it Stuart Little, Beetlejuice, or Thelma and Louise that you'd seen when you got cast in that role?
Stuart Little was the one that I initially, when somebody said Gina Davis, I was like, oh my God, Stuart Little's mum. Yeah. Then I was like, oh my God, Beetlejuice, because I'm a massive fan. And you know, I hadn't seen Thelma and Louise until I got cast and was like, oh, now I have to watch it. And that is like, I think that's one of my favorite movies of all time now. Not just
of all time.
Like, she is just, that movie is just incredible. It's such a good movie.
But Gina Davis, to me, would be in my top five actresses of all time.
Like, she's such a nice person. Like, she is such a good person.
Because that's my next question, is tell me every single thing you know about Gina Davis. Tell me, as though I can then tell other people, like, she's my friend.
She is such a, honestly, and I know, like, a lot of people who've worked with, like, big names or whatever, they say it because they're meant to say, like, she is the kindest. She's invited us over to her house for, like, dinners. Like, we've gone over, like, when she came over here last year for the Women and All About Women Festival in Sydney, and we went out for dinner, and, like, she walks the walk, but she also talks the talk. Like, she practices what she preaches. She's not just someone who's like, oh, it's great working with you, I'll see you next time. Like, she is a genuinely decent person who's a really good friend, and just like a really, I just can't find fault in her, which is scary because I know a lot of people, and you know, you have friends and you're like, oh, I've seen the dark side of you. I can't find anything wrong with the woman. She's just like she's a really genuinely good person.
Can you share with me what something she taught you as an actor?
Yeah, don't waste takes, because like I this was my first movie. I'd never actually said anything on camera before, and there's a scene at the end of the movie where we're all meant to be crying in the living room, and I was like really crying. I stopped. I was like, I'm not taking my antidepressants for this. No.
Yeah,
completely cried and cried and cried all day, and we did the first shot, and it was of her. And I started bawling my eyes out. And she went, come here, come here. I went over and she went, don't bother. I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, the camera's not on you. So don't bother, save it. She was like, fake it, pretend it. I think that's the biggest thing. Because I was like, well, you just cry. You do it every time. And it's like, there's just so cool, really. I found her just really cool camera tricks that I would never have probably learned had I not had her going. She was like, don't waste it. Don't waste your emotion on a shot that won't end up in the movie. Wait until the camera's on you and then start crying. And be kind. I think she taught me that. Like, she's just, not that I needed teaching that really, but...
But as an actor, to have some generosity of spirit.
Totally.
Is so important.
And no ego. I think that's the best thing. I'm so grateful for that, for it being my first movie as well, with like this legendary actor who's won an Oscar and who's this, you know, this icon in film. To be so damn cool and down to earth, like we'd play Scrabble and pass the pigs, like in between takes and stuff. And I think that was so helpful.
What about this film, your second film, Caught Inside? I mean, it was a horrific story.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. It wasn't a nice...
But how do you... I mean, in a horror movie, being an actor,
yeah,
how much do you have to disconnect from the horror that is the real story?
That movie, much scarier as well for us working in it, is that they shot it all chronologically, which is rare. They usually shoot it all back to front, or like
they chop you up at the start of the movie.
Yeah, get to know each other very, very quickly. But this one, they shot it where we shot literally the first scenes the day we got there, and then the second scenes the second day. So it was like we kind of all slowly started to implode anyway. We all started going
to go mad.
A bit mad. We were stuck on these boats. That was our accommodation. We had a accommodation boat that was like where we slept, and a set boat, which was where we shot. But it was, that was tough when I think by the end of it, everybody wanted to tear each other apart. And it just helped though, because the anger and sort of the violence in the actual movie, it wasn't real or anything, but I feel like it wasn't hard for us to slip into the characters, I guess, if that makes sense.
During that time coming back from making that film, or shortly after, was that when you went into rehab?
Yeah, so I came back, didn't have a job on the horizon for probably, I think it was like 6 months, and just blew all of my money. I think the fear of not having another job, it's such a horrible industry, because you come back feeling elated and you've been pampered to the bullshit. You feel like... It's very like, oh my God, I've been to the moon. And then you're right back down again. You're like, right, well, what are you doing now? It's very hard to sort of adjust your levels and be like, okay, back to reality. Because there is no such thing as reality, it seems like, after after doing it. So yeah, I just sort of self-imploded. I was so terrified that I would stop working and that I would just never get another job.
But didn't you feel like you were self-sabotaging? You're like, I want to work, but I'm going to drink.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, yeah, self-sabotage. I think as well, I was like, it just all boiled down to, I don't think I was very happy. I'd never really sort of gotten over the coming out thing. I think that was a major part of it. I don't think I really ever
addressed
it.
Comfortably being comfortable with your sexuality.
Yeah, and I think every time I wasn't working, playing pretend and being not somebody myself, I was myself and I had to be myself. And that sent me to the alcohol.
How much of being in rehab, though, was about talking about your sexuality over other feelings of anxiety?
Yeah, it's funny because once I cracked the egg open and told people about my sexuality at rehab...
Did you try not to tell them?
Yeah, I was petrified to tell them. It's so weird as well because I knew that I was going in there to like try and find some healing, but I was like, I'll heal, but that's not coming up. Like I was so embarrassed. It's so sad to think that that happens still, and that's like a lot of people do feel so ashamed or so like, I don't know. It is, for me anyway, I was so scared of being not liked on the case of who I am. But yeah, so when I told them that I was gay and I didn't get a bad response in rehab, I think that was when I started to go, okay, so maybe there is a lot more that I need to dig into about my sexuality. Maybe this is hurting me a lot more than I initially thought. Because I thought for a long time I was just drinking because I was unhappy, and I could never really trace back why it was that I was so unhappy or why I couldn't let go of the past or why I could never really talk to my dad anymore. I was miserable with my dad. But yeah, family week at rehab, me and my dad and my mum had to sort of, it was like an attempt to make amends.
So you had to sit down with your parents individually?
Yeah, yeah, and just sort of talk things out. And that was probably the most profound week of my life, I guess, when it comes to family. It was just a lot of crying and saying we're sorry, really. But sorry for the right things. I felt like my dad had finally, something had clicked. He'd learnt a lot in the 2 or 3 years.
From his PFLAG meetings.
From his PFLAG meetings, yep. And the good old internet. He just sort of had...
He'd put the work in, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And I have a lot of respect for it. Because, I mean, I don't blame people, not just my dad. I don't blame people in general for having ignorant views. I don't think that that's something that, you know, you can't help how you're conditioned and how you're brought up or how... you know, what you take in as a child. But I do blame people now in this day and age if you don't question and learn yourself now. I think that's a very big difference. I think if you're... It's 2018. I don't think there's really room anymore to be ignorant on subjects like sexuality. And you know, like, I think if you're...
Don't be so close-minded.
Totally. That's it. That's exactly it.
So after making these films, you know, having a few experiences and going through rehab, like, you know, your life at this point is just so full on, you decided to make a video to come out.
Yeah.
Were you aware of what impact, I guess, coming out as an actor would mean for your career?
Yeah, I think I did. I'd been told often, actually, just to not
come out as a gay man. Don't be gay and be an actor.
Don't be gay and be an actor, yeah. Which to me was always a contradiction because I thought, well... Straight people aren't told don't be straight. I remember there was a thing that Matt Damon did, and he was like, well, they don't need to come out as gay. They can just go on with that. Meanwhile, he takes his wife and his kids to every red carpet event, to every movie premiere that he ever has to go to. I would not have that luxury to do that, because by taking Liam along to an event, people would ask, well, who's this? Is this your friend? And I would either have to lie or I'd have to say, no, he's my husband, which is an admission that I'm not straight. Yeah. I am gay. So I felt like...
And it's important to raise Poppy to know that, you know...
Exactly.
Has beautiful parents.
Thank you, Benjamin.
For those out there that don't know, Poppy is your dog.
That's my dog, yeah. Yeah. We don't have a kid.
But Poppy needs to be able to be walked along a red carpet.
That's right.
Knowing that his dads are dads and they love each other.
Thank you.
And that you're allowed to make movies.
Exactly, yeah.
Gay people at the moment are being played by straight people 80% of the time.
Yes.
Oh, no, what was it? 95% of the time.
95% of the time, yeah.
Why are straight people allowed to play gay but gay people can't play straight?
Exactly. Well, the thing is, studios from the dawn of time have said, and I've been in meetings and with executives and producers who've gone, you know, there's audiences have a hard time believing that an openly gay actor can play a straight character. And I've often come back and gone, they don't have any issue watching films like Jurassic Park or Alien. Or so you're telling me where they will abandon their imagination when it comes to dinosaurs and aliens, but a man kissing a woman who's actually gay is just too much for the mind, and they don't know how to answer it because it is bullshit, really. Like, it's just a way of saying, no, you're not allowed the roles anymore, which is a shame because gay actors know how to play straight. We've done it our whole lives. You know, or not our whole lives.
In the film Drown, you play a straight person.
Yeah, funnily enough.
Yeah. Well, it's a gay movie, but you play a straight person.
Yeah, yeah.
But very convincingly.
Thank you.
But
thanks.
But that's the thing that people don't Thank understand you. Is that 9 times out of 10, why do we even care about the person's personal life?
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Why do we even care what happens?
If there's parody, like if I can start playing straight actors, sure, we can have... if I can start playing straight characters, sure, let all the straight actors play the gay characters, but that's not parody at the moment. Unfortunately, we don't have the equal playing field. Gay people aren't invited to play the straight roles. We're not invited to the table. We don't actually get the option to be in the room. So when all these gay characters are being made and they go to straight actors, you're like... Do you not have enough work? Like, they've got enough work. They're in all the action movies. We can't get action movies. We can't get drama. Like,
you could get action.
I could get action. Thank you, Benjamin.
You could do it. Action.
I could do it.
I'm mad.
Yeah.
With your book, how did you get to the point of deciding you wanted to turn your story into a novel? Did someone ask you to do that, or did you decide to write a book about your life?
I'm such a stationary lunatic. Like, I have like an Office Works card. Like, I'm a bit of an obsessive compulsive when it comes to Office Works. I journal like every day just because it's something that I do. And I'd been writing for a really long time, and my mum actually said not long ago, she was like, you could write a book. I was like, yeah, okay. And then I was like, yeah, actually, no, maybe I will. Yeah, no, maybe I will. And I just wrote a couple of chapters, and then had a couple of meetings with some big publishers. She said, oh, I think there's actually like quite a cool story there. And I met with some publishers. It was during the postal plebiscite was going on, and they said, this is a good time
for this is a good
book
gay
like
story
this. Yeah,
this is a good LGBTI hero story.
Yeah, wow, that's very sweet. That's very sweet.
When you were writing Pink Ink, who were you writing this book for?
I always thought it would be like parents of young gay kids at first. I thought it would be out to the masses of parents who will one day be told that they have a gay kid, and to not freak out because it's not the end of the world. But now I actually think I think it's a story for sort of, well, everybody, but I would like to think that young gay kids can read it and go, oh, okay, so it might be really shitty and it might get really, really hard, but you can actually have a really great end it. You know, you can get through it and come out swinging. You can be really, really happy at the end.
This is the bad point of my life, and it gets better.
Yeah.
Who would you say are your idols now?
I would honestly say my mum, dad, brother, and Liam. I really look up to them. And I know that probably sounds quite corny, but I feel like everything we've all been through together, I have so much respect for them. So I think that's probably where it comes from. I really do look up to them all. I just think every single one of them like teaches me something every day. We're really close. We're a really tight little family. And yeah, I would have to say I look up to them.
I've left this to the end on purpose, and it's because nobody wants to hear people talk about how in love they are and all the rest of it. But the story of you finding your husband is just beautiful.
Oh,
that you went into like to get the coffee and...
Yeah.
Is that a real story?
Random, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I love that.
Never happened.
How long have you two been together for now?
Eight years in January.
Yeah, so, isn't it weird? Because I think you and I share the same thing. It's like, I was a crazy person growing up.
Were you?
And I, yeah, literally like a crazy person. And then to think I have a normal relationship.
Yeah.
I found someone normal to
yes.
balance me out.
That's it. That's exactly how I feel like.
And imagine if anything ever happened to Ben or anything ever happened to Liam, you and I would go off the rails.
Yeah.
We'd be dead.
Yes, absolutely. I would be dead. Yes, we are best friends now. Just so you know, this is how it happens. We are now best friends because I'm exactly the same. He is just the balance on the scales that I need, because without him, I lose my mind. Like, I'm a mess of a human being. I'm well aware of that. And he is just very, very... He just knows how to get through life. And I've never really gotten it. I don't really understand how to...
What does he do for work?
Film and TV insurance. So he works on... He, like, insures the productions and
wow.
Very cool.
So that's what he was doing while you guys were in LA together?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, right. What is next for you?
Oh, early retirement.
Wait, is there a particular type of genre of film that you're looking to make now?
I would love to do an action movie. And they're so rare anyway. They're so hard to come along. Do you know what? I'm so open to anything. I love film. I really love film work. I think of that's any kind of film work I'm interested in. And I'm not saying I wouldn't do television. I love television as well. But I'm such a sucker for a movie. I don't know. And I've done both television and film and theatre as well. But I think I'm, there's something about
like making film.
Film, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's just because it's a whole story in one. Whereas television, it sort of goes on and on and on.
Have you got a message for the queer community out there that has had the privilege of listening to this podcast?
Oh, I love you all. And if you are wouldn't mind taking a moment to give my book a go, I would be eternally grateful. And thank you so much for having me on this. You are a pleasure. A pleasure. And I will be coming back once a week.
Once a week. To watch me record the next episodes. Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode of Word for Word.
Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the Community Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.